And hello, Sun's House listeners. This is Andy Bombeck, which means, once again, it's time for the Children's Story Hour. And as always, I'm glad you could join me today for a good variety of children's stories. Like always, the first half hour, I'll be reading picture books. And then the second half hour, I'm going to begin a brand new novel this week, titled 57 Bus. But first, let's begin today's program with the picture book titles. I'm going to start off with a book titled Something Someday. And then it's Nothing in Common, Beauty and the Beaker, Astronaut Sisters, Soul Step, and if we have time, we'll finish up the first half hour with There Was a Party for Langston, King of Letters. So it should be a lot of fun. Let's get started with our first picture book today, which is titled Something Someday. You are told that this is not a problem, but you're sure there's something wrong, and it shows this little boy surrounded by all this garbage. You were told that this cannot be fixed, but you know that you can help, and it shows a broken shopping cart. You were told that this is too big for you, but you've seen the tiniest things make a huge difference, and there's an ant pushing a donut. You're told that this won't work, but how will you know if you never try? And it shows this little boy picking up small bits of garbage. You're told to sit and wait, but you know people have already waited too long. And it shows this one woman sitting in a wheelchair and this little boy pulling a cart of things to grow a plant. You're told that what's going on is very, very sad. But you're not just sad. You're scared and confused. You're angry. And it shows this other guy just tossing a bottle on the street. And maybe, just maybe, a little hopeful. And it shows a flower poking up through all this garbage. You're told not to hope, but you keep hoping anyway. And it shows a little boy with a broom. He's cleaning off a space. Sometimes you feel like you're all alone. But someday, somewhere, you find a friend. Someone who will hope with you. Who believes in your dream. Someone who will fight with you. You make a promise to each other. You say, there is a problem. But it's our problem together. So we can fix it together. This problem is big, but together we are bigger. You make another friend and tell them it's okay to be sad. And they tell you sometimes we'll lose, but that's all right, we'll try again. And so you do, together working, together beginning, over and over and over and over. And it shows three boys and a guy in a wheelchair making a flower box. Until you're no longer beginning, you're winning, and now the flower box has all kinds of flowers inside it. Suddenly, there's something you're sure is right, something you know you helped fix, something small that changed, something big, something that worked, something that makes you feel hopeful, happy, and love. And now there's all kinds of people around the flower box. Something that is not a dream, but the day you live in. Something that makes you smile as you tell someone else and as people walking by the flower box. Nothing in common. They had nothing in common, so they never waved. And there's two people, each in their own apartment, separate. Except every day, they loved watching the old man with his dog. The dog could do marvelous things, and did. things they felt under the floors of their hearts. But other than that, they had nothing in common. Still, they were the only ones who noticed when one day was different. Neither had ever seen an old man cry, or heard a name called so sadly it flies through your window and lands on your chest. It happened just to them. When morning came, they both went out with binoculars and a helmet for thinking, because a marvelous dog could be anywhere, doing anything. And a marvelous friend is hard to find. They both knew that. They looked on the same quiet rooftops, and under the same whale, and near the same planets. And they thought of the same old man crying because he's without his dog. But other than that, they had nothing in common. That day, when a hot air balloon floated over the city, they were the only ones who thought a dog might be flying it. A marvelous dog who was lost and looking for his friend far and wide. It could happen. Only they knew that. It was a big way for a dog to look for someone, and a big thing for just the two of them to notice. But dogs aren't birds. They can't see their way home from the sky, especially a dog without binoculars. And a balloon is a great moon with ropes. You need another person with a helmet. And now they're reaching up for the ropes on the balloon. Someone who knows exactly where a balloon dog wants to go. Someone marvelous like that. It was a slow walk, one with time to notice things. Things they hadn't noticed before. Tall things. How patient a dog in the sky is. How they both had the same feeling inside. A deep feeling that ballooned out. And now they're pulling the hot air balloon with the dog inside it down. They pulled and pulled. And they knew the same way back. Because they knew the same stars. And the same earth. And the same quiet rooftops they saw every night from their windows. And because they'd noticed the same old man every day, just the two of them, an old man who cried, this time because he was happy. And now the old man is reunited with his dog. Because the dog could do marvelous things, and did. Each thought the other was marvelous too, even though they'd had nothing in common. Nothing. And that's something. And the last picture shows the two strangers waving to each other. Beauty and the Beaker. In a tiny island town, there lived a nature seeker. Beauty was a scientist. She always had a beaker. And a beaker, if you don't know, is like a glass. Curious about the world, she spent her days collecting, bringing samples to her lab for testing and inspecting. Scoops of sand and sediment, some fungi from the sea, algae from the nearby pond, or seaweed floating free. Studying the things she found was what she loved to do. Heating, cooling, magnifying, mixing, shaking too. Beauty checked the weather guide. A storm is on its way. She closed the windows and the doors. I'll just stay in today. Sometimes, when it stormed outside, the island would lose power. Usually, the lights were out, no longer than an hour. All the paper's headlines read, "This cyclone is a beast. It may make landfall on our town, directly from the east." And now the lights were flickering. "Oh, curses," Beauty said. But this time everything stayed dark until she went to bed. When she woke up with the sun, she hoped things were okay. But then she stepped outside her home in total disarray. There's garbage everywhere. Garbage cans are knocked over, power lines. The cyclone rocked the island town. Trees and bushes flew. It knocked down all the power lines. The generators blew. Would the power come back on? The town was in a quandary. Work had stopped. No one could cook or even do their laundry. While repairs were underway and all the clocks were blinking, Beauty headed to her lab and quickly got to thinking. First, she checked the substances she'd gathered from outside. Maybe there's a power source that we have never tried. She took the algae from the pond. Let's see what this could be. She drained it, then she crushed it down to set the oil free. She stirred in several chemicals. The oil separated. She gave it all a little shake. Then patiently, she waited. She placed a wick into the oil, then struck a match to light it. Soon, it burned a tiny flame. Young Beauty was excited. Beauty ran the test again. The oil is the key. I may have just discovered a new form of energy. She gathered her community and showed them what she found. We'll have to grow more algae here and care for it year-round. We'll use it as a power source for cars and lights and heat. So when the next storm barrels through, this island won't be beat. They used some empty swimming pools, the perfect place to start. The town agreed to grow the plants, and everyone took part. Beauty's farms gave purpose, hope, and jobs to everyone. The beast had come to fight and lost. The islanders had won. Scientists flew from afar to learn what Beauty knew and bring back her discovery to their home countries too. Beauty spoke to eager crowds, "The future's in our hands, and new green forms of energy can power many lands." Over time, the algae grew, and power soon was steady. Yet Beauty kept her beaker close, so she was always ready. Astronaut Sisters. "Let's play astronauts today," said Fern. "Okay," said Rosie. "Snow suits," said Rosie. "Space suits," said Fern. "Boots," said Rosie. "Space boots," said Fern. "Helmets," said Rosie. "Space helmets," said Fern. "Gloves," said Rosie. "Space gloves," said Fern. At breakfast, they sipped juice and ate cereal just like astronauts do. "Hold on to your juice box," said Rosie. "Everything floats in outer space." When Papa took them to the park, he was their home base and the playground was their universe. They loved spinning and flying and imagining that they were sailing miles above the clouds to a space station that circled the Earth 16 times in one day, cruising past 16 sunrises and sunsets. That night, as Rosie and Fern watched the real space station crossing the starry sky, they imagined they were traveling with a real astronaut. Then, snug in their rocket ship sleeping bags, they dreamed and drifted through the silent night. The next morning, they got into their car, their pretend space capsule, and glided safely down to Earth and onto a street where there was a parade, a real homecoming. For a real, very special astronaut who had been gone for a very long time. Mama. Soul Step. Where me and Mama live, not many people look like us. Sometimes that makes Mama sad as can be. Like when the police stop her twice in one day, asking if she lives in the neighborhood. Days like that, Mama puts on her dancing boots and gets to what she calls steppin'. Stomp, clap, flip, flap, go hard, snap back. Let your soul step, she shouts. She's loud like thunder or a big old drum. What's up with that? Mama says, go ask Dr. Jameson. Now, Dr. J's not the medicine kind of doctor. She's the teaching, preaching kind. She always wears the colors of Africa, head scarves, and long necklaces. And boy, does she have a lot to say. Steppen's roots go all the way back to slavery. But Step didn't pop until sisters and brothers went to college. That's where I met your mama, in a sorority. A sorority's a group of women who look out for each other no matter what. Step is a tradition passed down for generations. Then, get this, Dr. J steps too. Stomp, clap, flip, flap, go hard, snap back. Soul step. Dr. J's loud like thunder, or a big old drum. Who knew? But what's this tradition about anyway? Mama says, call Aunt Sharifa. She stepped in middle school. Aunt Sharifa says, step got me through good times and bad. Whenever I got bullied, I'd find my sisters and step. When I got an A in math, I'd step then, too. Stomp, clap, flip, flap, go hard, snap back. Step is sisterhood. Sisters lift you up. I report back to Mama. Aunt Sharifa says I should join a step team. Mama laughs. Sharifa's not wrong. She tells me to call Miss May. Hear what she has to say. Truth be told, I'm in awe of Miss May. She is a community organizer. Her t-shirts always shout, Black Lives Matter. Step is a megaphone for our resistance, she says. It's a loud, proud way of showing the world how strong we really are. Stomp, clap, flip, flap, go hard, snap back. Soul step. That's Miss May, loud like thunder or a big old drum. I've learned step is tradition, sisterhood, and a megaphone. But none of that explains why Mama steps after a bad day. Like when a white woman at the grocery store asked to touch her hair. Mama, I say, how come steppin' makes you feel better? Mama grabs my hand. I'll show you. How's that? With dinner cooking, she walks me through the moves. First, catch the rhythm. Feel it in your soul. Then you flip, flap, stomp, clap. Don't forget, snap back. Now finish with a divider. Right, then left. How do you feel? I flex, strong, happy. I love steppin' with you. Not just me, steppin', you're dancing with sisters all over the world. Sisters who've gotten through hard times and did it with their heads held high. Step is thunder, a big old drum. Step is noise, loud and proud. Step is joy, shout out loud. Finally, I get why Mama says steppin', Dr. J, Aunt Sharifa, and Miss May, too. I can feel it in my flip-flap bones. Where I live, not many people look like me. Sometimes that makes me sad as can be. Like when the teacher says I play too rough at recess, even though I'm playing like everybody else. Those days, I put on my glittery shoes, head to Miss Julia's dance studio, and step with my new team. Stomp, clap, flip-flap, go hard, snap back. Now we're thunder, a big old drum. When we step, we're the best of the best. How do I know? All my steppin' sisters, they tell me so. Step is noise, loud and proud. Step is joy, shout out loud. There was a party for Langston, King of Letters. There was a party for Langston at the library, a jam in Harlem to celebrate the word-making man. And this is Langston Hughes. February 1991. Langston, the King of Letters, whose ABCs became drums, bumping, jumping, thumping, like a heart the size of the whole wide world. Langston was the best word maker around, could make the word mother feel like real warm arms wrapped around you, giving a snug hug. Could make the word America look like two friends making pinky promises to be cool, to be true. Could make the word Harlem sound like the perfect place to have a party. Make it seem like you could bust a move right there in the H or the L or the M of it. There was a blowout for Langston to celebrate the man who wrote Wake Up Stories and Rise and Shine Rhymes, Dreams We've Dreamed. Ever since he was just a little boy, daydreaming under the Ohio sky. Fling my arms wide in the face of the sun, turning birds into words flying all around him, imagining the clouds as paper to put them on, the best word maker in his class. But not everyone understood Langston. Some people thought it was better to be word breakers, thought his spelling deserved yelling, wanted to take words like free and love and cut them in half, pull them apart, keep all the letters from touching and sharing. Some folks think by burning books, they burn freedom. Keep the big H's with the little H's and the big A's with the little A's. But Langston, the brave word maker, knew letters were better together. Turned them into laughter. But freedom stands up in and laughs in their faces. And that laughter rang out for years and years in cities and towns, on trains and tractors, to classrooms and bedrooms, bringing joy to the little and the big. And that's why there was a party for Langston at the library, a fancy foot, get down, all out bash. And all the books on the shelves were listening and looking at all the people, shimmering, full of dazzle. Don't nobody dance like a word maker, and all the best word makers were there. James Baldwin, Gwendolyn Brooks, Ashley Bryan, Octavia Butler, County Cullen, Webb DeBose, Paul Lawrence Dunbar, Alice Dunbar Nelson, Ralph Ellison, Nikki Giovanni, Alex Haley, Zora Nellie Hurston, and Claude McKay. Like Maya. Oh, Papa Da, who Langston language laughter tickled as a child. Live black. Stand infinite freedom, love enough dream, heart promise. Who grew up reading his words and learned to make words of her own. She could make the word woman seem like the word mountain, and the word cage feel like a place far, far away. From this library, this party, Maya dressed in constellations, stars dangling from her, she rose up from the floor, flapping like a free bird, flapping so freely with wings unbroken. Amari, another one of Langston's word children, was at the party too. Came bopping in, dressed in his good clothes and his soft shoes, black, his favorite word, on his tongue. Amari could make the word black sound like it could be red. Could make the word black echo into the future and way back into the past. Back to Langston. Amari came to recite poems at his hero's feet. Came to dance, boom da boom, boom da boom, boom boom. Came to offer his rickety radio heart to Langston, the man who wrote. Magic Land, dance. His neighborhood as America, and his family as America, and his funky music as America, and America as America, too. The man who wrote Maya and Amari into the world. And Maya and Amari danced, like the best words do, together, dazzled together. They held hands and swung and spun and slid, stepping and stomping, and boogie-woogie wiggling wild. Oh, what a time, to gather together, to gather together. Until they lifted their heads to the word-making boy who had grown up to be a word-making man and had now become the word-making king. To Langston, for Langston. And let laughter fill the library. Laughter, the language of ha-ha-ha, loud, like the love in the library that night, in all that hoopla in Harlem, at that party, where the books were looking on as new words were being written. where the books were listening, just like you. And here's a note from the author. It all started when I saw a picture of two of my favorite word makers, Maya Angelou and Amari Baraka, dancing. But why were they dancing? I never even knew word makers could dance. I always thought they were just the people who put together cool poems like Caged Bird and Legacy. These poems I loved as a kid. Or the people who spoke out courageously about freedom and a way to become better people and a more loving America. Turns out they also loved to boogie, especially when the party was in honor of word maker of all word makers, Langston Hughes, who wrote my favorite poems, The Negro Speaks of Rivers and Mother to Son. And that's only two. He wrote hundreds of other poems that can make you nod your head and tap your feet. Do a little shimmy. That's what those poems did for Maya and Amari and a whole bunch of other people who danced for Langston in the library. That's what Langston's words did for me and what I hope this book does for you. J.R. And this is just a reminder, my name is Andy Bomick, and I hope you're enjoying the Children's Story Hour. And as I mentioned at the beginning of today's program, for the second half hour, I'm going to actually begin a brand new novel that's titled The 57 Bus, a true story of two teenagers and the crime that changed their lives. One teenager was in a skirt, one teenager with a lighter. One moment that changes both of their lives forever. If it weren't for the 57 bus, Sasha and Richard never would have met. Both were high school students in Oakland, California, one of the most diverse cities in the country. But they inhabited different worlds. Sasha lived in the middle-class foothills and attended a small private school. Richard lived in the economically challenged flatlands and attended a large public one. After school each day, their paths overlapped on the bus for a mere 8 minutes. But one afternoon, a single reckless act left Sasha severely burned and Richard charged with two hate crimes and facing life imprisonment. The case garnered international attention, thrusting both teenagers into the spotlight. But in the 57 bus, author Dashika Slater shows that what might at first seem like a simple matter of right and wrong, justice and injustice, victim and criminal, is something more complicated and far more heartbreaking. And this is a true story. Monday, November the 4th, 2013. By 4:30 in the afternoon, the first mad rush of after-school passengers has come and gone. What's left are stragglers and stay-laters, swiping their bus passes as they climb onto the 57 bus and take seats among the coming home workers, the shoppers, and errand-doers, the other students from high schools and middle schools around the city. The bus is loud, but not as loud as sometimes. A few clusters of kids are shouting and laughing, and an older woman at the front keeps talking to the driver. Dark is coming on. Daylight savings ended yesterday, and now evening rushes into the place where afternoon used to be. Everything is duskier, sleepier, winterier now. Passengers look at their phones or stare through the scratched and grimy windows at the waning light. Sasha sits near the back. For much of the journey, the teenager has been reading a paperback copy of Anna Karenina for a class in Russian literature. Today, like most days, Sasha wears a t-shirt, a black fleece jacket, a gray flat cap, and a gauzy white skirt. A senior at a small private high school, the teenager identifies as a gender, neither male nor female. As the bus lumbers through town, Sasha puts down the book and drifts into sleep. skirt draped over the edge of the seat. A few feet away, three teenage boys are laughing and joking. One of them, Richard, wears a black hoodie and an orange-billed New York Knicks hat. A 16-year-old junior at Oakland High School, he's got hazel eyes and a slow, sweet grin. He stands with his back to Sasha, gripping a pole for balance. Sasha sleeps as Richard and his companions goof around, play fighting. Sleeps as Richard's cousin, Lloyd, bounds up and down the aisle, flirting with a girl up front. Sleeps as Richard serendipitously flicks a lighter and touches it to the hem of that gauzy white skirt. Wait. In a moment, Sasha will wake inside a ball of flame and begin to scream. In a moment, everything will be set in motion. Taken by ambulance to a San Francisco burn unit, Sasha will spend the next 3.5 weeks undergoing multiple surgeries to treat second and third degree burns running from calf to thigh. Arrested at school the following day, Richard will be charged with 2 felonies, each with a hate crime clause that will add time to his sentence if he is convicted. Citing the severity of the crime, the district attorney will charge him as an adult, stripping him of the protections normally given to juveniles. Before the week is out, he will be facing the possibility of life imprisonment. But none of that has happened yet. For now, both teenagers are just taking the bus home from school. Surely, it's not too late to stop things from going wrong. There must be some way to wake Sasha, divert Richard, get the driver to stop the bus. There must be something you can do. Oakland, California. Oakland, California is a city of more than 400,000 people, but it can still feel like a small town. Not small geographically, of course. The city sprawls across 78 square miles, stretching from the shallow, salty estuary at the edge of San Francisco Bay to the undulating green and gold hills where bobcats and coyotes roam. What makes it feel small is the web of connections, the way people's stories tangle together. Our lives make footprints, tracks in the snows of time. People know each other's parents or siblings, their aunties and cousins. They go to school together or worship together. They play sports on the same team or work in the same building. The tracks cross. The stories overlap. Oakland is considered one of the most diverse cities in the country. It's Asian and Latino, black and white, African, Arab, Indian, Iranian, Native American, and Pacific Islander. No one group is a majority. It has more lesbian couples per capita than any city in the nation, and one of the largest proportions of gay and lesbian-headed households. It's a city that prides itself on its open-mindedness, its lack of pretension, and its homegrown slang. Oaklanders say hella when they mean very and hecka when they want to be polite about it. But for all its laid-back inclusiveness, Oakland is also a city of stark contrast. In 2013, the year Sasha was burned, Oakland ranked 7th among American cities in income inequality, just below New York. Its per capita rate of violent crimes made it the 2nd most dangerous city in America, but its citizens still paid some of the highest rents in the country. Gravity works backward here. The money flows uphill. The wealthier neighborhoods in the hills boast good schools, low crime, and views of the Bay. Thanks to the Bay Area's high-tech boom, long vacant historic buildings downtown are filled with startups, boutiques peddling handmade jeans, and night spots serving 7-ingredient cocktails. But little of this good fortune spilled over into the flatlands of East Oakland, where Richard lived. This is where the bulk of the city's murders happen, 2/3 of them in 2013. The schools are shabbier here. The test scores are lower. There's more trash on the streets, more roaming dogs, more liquor stores, fewer grocery stores. The median strips are ragged with weeds. The 57 bus travels through both kinds of neighborhoods, traversing an 11-mile path from one end of the city to the other. It begins at the northwest corner of Oakland and lumbers diagonally through the city, crossing the middle-class foothills where Sasha lived and where Richard went to school, and then chugging along MacArthur Boulevard for 120 blocks. The route terminates at the city's southeast border, close to Richard's house. Each afternoon, the two teenagers' journeys overlapped for a mere 8 minutes. If it hadn't been for the 57 bus, their paths might never have crossed at all. Part 1, Sasha. Tumbling, adapted from Sasha's Tumblr page. Favorite vegetable, bok choy. Favorite animals, cat and cuttlefish. Favorite type of movie, dream sequences. Three best qualities, navigation. My friends seem to like me, and purple. Of course, I like hats. Anyone who doesn't is wrong. I like compliments. I dislike compliments. I like my hair. I give good hugs. I'm good at finding potential puns. If the whole world was listening, I might just rant about a bunch of things like gender, wealth, inequality. Why school is important. I like parties. I dislike parties. I don't really keep track of disappointments. Ideal vacation spot? Probably a city with a nice subway. Thinking of things to get me? Try this. A brass airship. A transit map shower curtain. A medieval clock. A corset with silver buttons. A chiseled chunk of gallium that melts in your palms. A dress swirled with the image of a nebula. A Victorian house on wheels. Tights painted like a mermaid tail. Even as a toddler, Sasha was interested in language. Not in learning Italian or Swahili or Mandarin, but in language itself, its shape and structure. The Lego blocks of sounds that snap together to make words and sentences. Most toddlers are interested in the fact that the animal with two pointy ears and a long tail is called a cat. Sasha was interested in the fact that adding an S at the end of the word cat made it plural. Look, Sasha would say, two cats. Before turning three, Sasha was matching sounds with letters, sometimes in unusual ways. B is for baby, Sasha would exclaim. Y is for wire. 10 is for tent. At four, Sasha was reading independently, but had also begun contemplating the shape of letters. K is one rectangle and two parallelograms. Sasha announced at the breakfast table one day, M is two parallelograms and two rectangles. 2 years later, Sasha began creating a new language. It was called Astrolinguish, and it was the language of Sasha's home planet. Astrolingua, written Astrolinguish, was awash in diacritical marks, with lots of umlauts, accents, and tides. The spoken language luxated in rolled R's and L's. As a senior in high school, Sasha was still inventing languages, hanging out online with other conlangers, people who construct language of their own. By now, Sasha was working up a new language. This one never had a name, but it was spoken by the members of an imaginary agricultural society, something like that of ancient Mesopotamia. All languages embody the obsessions of the people who speak them, and so Sasha's language was meant to reflect the interest of a people whose world was dominated by growing seasons, grains, and harvest. Instead of pronouns that distinguish between male and female, Sasha's language had pronouns that distinguish between animate and inanimate objects. The word for sun was Jesus, which was also the word for day. The difference was that sun was considered animate and being, and day was considered inanimate a thing. Our language, English, works differently. We care a lot about gender, and English reflects that in its pronouns. She or he, her or him, hers or his. You might think this is just how languages work in the real world, but there are many languages on Earth that are basically gender neutral, using the same word for he, she, and it, or not using pronouns at all. You've probably heard some of them. They include Armenian, Comanche, Finnish, Hungarian, Hindi, Indonesian, Quechua, Thai, Tagalog, Turkish, Vietnamese, and Yoruba. English, on the other hand, poses a challenge for people like Sasha who don't see themselves as fitting into neat either-or categories, like male or female. Sasha, like many gender nonconforming people, wants to be referred to with a pronoun they. It might feel awkward at first, but you'll get used to it. 1001 blank white cards. For their 16th birthday, Sasha asked for an accordion, a manual typewriter, a Soviet flag, and a new Rubik's Cube. They didn't know how to play the accordion, but they might have learned if they had received one, which they didn't. They didn't get the flag either, though Sasha and their friend Michael made a cardboard hammer and sickle not long afterward and hung it on Sasha's bedroom wall. At the time, they were obsessed with everything having to do with Russia and communism. Their friend Carrie, who took the bus with Sasha that year, remembers Sasha going on and on about it during the bus ride home from school. Sasha, once you get to know them, is very outspoken about things, she explains. That's once you get to know them. When you first meet Sasha, they're quiet and shy. They have chin-length, wavy brown hair, a pale round face, and thick, dark eyebrows. When they smile, their eyes crinkle into slits. They wear glasses, round owlish ones, and they don't always look at you straight on. As a child, they were diagnosed with Asperger's, a form of autism, which can make them awkward socially, but it also makes them passionate about their interest, and the passion eventually trumps the shyness. What was Sasha passionate about when they were a senior in high school? Buses, cartoons, and the color purple, says Healy, one of Sasha's closest friends. To that, you could add communism, games, the web comic Homestruck, and live-action role-playing or LARPing. Also, the ska pop punk band Sarcasm, which was formed by some kids at Maybeck High School and had once proclaimed Sasha their biggest fan. And veganism, although Sasha disliked the way other vegans on the internet made such a huge deal about it. Sasha's best friend was Michael, a tall, gangly kid with sandy blonde hair and thick glasses who always wore a gray beanie and a green army jacket. Michael and Sasha had been pretty much inseparable since freshman year, when they met while playing the board game Diplomacy. Over time, they formed the nucleus of a tight circle of friends, Sasha, Healy, Michael, Michael's girlfriend, Tia, and another friend named Ian. Ian, blonde, bearded, with a habit of tucking his chin and looking up at you from under his eyebrows, was the one who never stopped talking. Red-haired Healy was the unquellable fountain of excitement who stole people's hats and wore her emotions on her sleeve. Cherub-faced Tia loved costumes and dancing. She and Michael were so close that their friends referred to them as a single person named Titchell. When the two got too cuddly, Sasha would get between them and shout, "Leave room for Jesus," at the top of their lungs, like the chaperone at a Christian prom. Sasha was the brilliant one, the one who blazed through calculus, linguistics, physics, and computer programming with a kind of effortlessness. Not that any of them were slouches when it came to academics. Kids who weren't into school were unlikely to choose Maybach, a private high school with roughly 100 kids that rented space on two floors of a Presbyterian church in Berkeley. In the tiny classrooms, students gathered around conference tables and critiqued the concept of America as a shining city on a hill, or compared the writings of Charles Darwin and Ursula K. Le Guin. Teachers liked to claim that Maybach didn't have cliques like other high schools, and it was true that the place was a refuge for kids like Healy, who had been bullied in middle school. People were nice to each other at Maybach, accepting, but the school still had social groupings, just like any other high school, arty kids, stoners, bros. "We were the nerdy kids," Ian says, "the funny, sort of crazy nerdy people who played video games and watched anime and read manga. All of them were fascinated by games, board games, video games, card games, role-playing games, trading card games. At lunch and after school, they often gathered at a wooden table in the hallway that people called the hex table, even though, as Ian pointed out, it was an octagon, not a hexagon. There, they played cards, particularly a game Michael and Sasha had learned from a couple of seniors when they were freshmen. It was officially called 1001 Blank White Cards, although they mostly just called it Index Cards. It's a game played with index cards," Sasha explains, "not all of which are white, and at this point, very few which are blank. The deck grew over time with people pilfering index cards from classrooms whenever they wanted to expand it. If you drew a blank card from the deck, that meant you could fill it in, assigning it a point value and an effect. The more random, the better. Over time, the deck filled up with in-jokes. There was a card featuring a drawing of The Sun Also Rises by Ernest Hemingway that resulted in the player losing two turns as you read the book and are bored to death. There was a card that required you to talk in a Russian accent, a card that required you to lisp, and a card that required you to lisp while talking in a Russian accent. There were cards that required you to play an air guitar solo, speak like an English-dubbed anime character, eat leaves like a giraffe, engage in staring contest, and end every sentence with the word dog. There was a card called Tower of Hats that required you to take everyone else's hats and wear them in a stack. There was a card that said, Game Over, Ian Wins, that had been created as a birthday present for Ian. Sasha created a card called A Complete History of the Soviet Union, as told by a humble worker, arranged to the melody of Tetris, which was the name of a 6.5-minute song by an obscure British comedy band called Pig, with the face of a boy. Michael and Sasha were both obsessed with the song and sang it at every opportunity. The effect of the card is that you have to sing the song or lose a turn, Sasha explains. Aside from Ian's birthday card, there was no way to win the game and no real goal. They just played until people had to go home. By graduation, the stack of index cards was about 2 feet high and had to be carried in a special bag. But at the beginning, most of those 1,001 white cards were blank. Back then, Sasha was called Luke, and they were referred to as he. Luke and Samantha. In middle school, Sasha was brainy, shy, and introverted, the kind of kid who is easy to overlook. Sasha's father, Carl, refers to that quality as Sasha's invisibility cloak. They blend into the background, he explains. They've always been that sort of kid that nobody even knows they're there. Sasha didn't seem to need other people much. In fact, they often said that the world would be better off without humans in it at all. The world inside their head was fascinating enough. They thought about numbers a lot and shapes and the size of the universe. They drew imaginary subway maps and worked out math problems on a whiteboard the family kept in the breakfast nook. And unfortunately, this is where I'm going to have to stop today because we are out of time. I hope that everyone enjoyed today's program as much as I did. I want to say hi to all the listeners out there, and I want to encourage everyone to tune in next week when I continue with the novel, The 57 Bus. Until then, I hope everyone has a great day and a fantastic week. So long and take care, everyone. Goodbye.